This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. One of the pillar arguments for homosexuality is that people are born this way. They're genetically predisposed to this sexual orientation, and so judging them for it is the same as judging someone for being black or being Jewish. Well, a new group of people is using the same argument, and a couple of articles that have appeared in mainstream sources recently saying that society needs to be more accepting of this group because their sexual orientation is also genetically predetermined, and that is pedophiles. We're going to talk about this argument and its implications for society. A new study by the leading authorities on global disease shows that the number one cause for premature death in the world is poor diet. This report tells us about some specific things that we're putting in our mouths that are killing us. We're going to talk with a professional nutritionist about this report and get some tips on how to clean up our diets in order to feel better and to live longer. 600 years ago this week, one of the most famous battles in British history took place, the Battle of Agincourt. This was the scene of Shakespeare's famous play, Henry V. It's still considered one of the high spots in Britain's long history of warfare. We're going to remember what happened in this battle, the effect that it had on Britain, and the aspects of it that still stir our admiration to this day. And we'll finish off the program with a word about keeping your word to your children. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Do genetics determine morality? A major argument of the homosexual lobby is that same-sex attraction is genetically determined, that people are born homosexual. And the argument that follows is, because that is the case, then for anyone to suggest that there's something wrong with same-sex attraction is just as hateful, just as bigoted as it is to condemn someone for their skin color, for their race. You know, you don't have any control over it, so how can you condemn it? It must be right. And they would condemn any effort to change someone's sexual orientation as wrong. They say that that is morally reprehensible. Some go as far as to say that, say, if a young boy starts putting on girls' clothes, that should be encouraged. Anybody who would stop him or try to correct him, well, they're going to do him great psychological harm. After all, you can't change your genes. Okay, maybe your genes made you born with a certain sex, a certain set of body parts, but if you're also born with an idea in your mind that your gender is actually the opposite of your biology, well, we all need to give priority to the idea in your head, so the reasoning goes. If someone is born with an attraction to their own sex, then it's morally wrong to try to change that. Well, if genetics determines morality, that has some serious implications. And in recent years, a movement has begun growing to extend the same kind of argument and the same kind of tolerance that people use to justify homosexuality, extend that to a new group of people, and that is pedophiles, people who are sexually attracted to children. Michael L. Brown wrote a book called A Queer Thing Happened to America a few years back, and he wrote this in a Christian Post article from September 28th. He said, some psychiatric leaders who were instrumental in removing homosexuality from the American Psychiatric Association's list of mental disorders in 1973 have been fighting to remove pedophilia as a disorder as well, not to justify the abuse of children, but rather to say that being sexually attracted to children is not a mental disorder. I want to just read to you a bit of an article that was run in the Los Angeles Times of January 14th, 2013. The article is titled, Many Researchers Taking a Different View of Pedophilia. And the quip for the article is, pedophilia once was thought to stem from psychological influences early in life. Now, many experts view it as a deep-rooted predisposition that does not change. And here are a couple of quotes from the article. It says, pedophilia once was thought to stem from psychological influences early in life. Now many experts view it as a sexual orientation as immutable as heterosexuality or homosexuality. This article quotes a man saying that he was caught with child pornography and he was sent to court and they ordered him to go to therapy. And this article says quotes him as saying, these people felt they could snuff out the desire or shame me into denying it existed, but it's as intrinsic as the next person's heterosexuality. This article also says scientists at the Center for Mental Health and Addiction in Toronto have uncovered a series of associations that suggest pedophilia has biological roots. And really, genetics, we've been talking about your genes, genetics determining morality. It's basically saying that there is a biological reason for pedophilia. In his book, Michael Brown documents how the very same arguments that have been used to normalize homosexuality are now being used to try to normalize pedophilia. He lists 8 of these main arguments in this Christian Post article, and I'll just read them to you verbatim from this article. He says, and I just, as I go through these, if you just think about these arguments and you substitute homosexuality for all of them, you can see this is exactly the line of reasoning that has been used for that movement. Number one, pedophilia is innate and immutable. People are born this way and cannot change. Number two, pederasty is richly attested in many different cultures throughout history. Number three, the claim that adult-child sexual relationships cause harm is greatly overstated and often completely inaccurate. Number four, consensual adult-child sex can actually be beneficial to the child. And there have actually been famous homosexual activists who have said that they were molested as children and that it benefited them, that they were actually better off because that happened to them. Number five, pederasty should not be classified as a mental disorder since it does not cause distress to the pederast to have these desires, and since the pederast can function as a normal contributing member of society. Number six, many of the illustrious homosexuals of the past were actually pedophiles. Number seven, people are against intergenerational intimacy because of antiquated social standards and puritanical sexual phobias. And number eight, this is all about love and equality and liberation. Now, again, if you just substitute homosexuality for all of these arguments, you can see it's exactly the line of reasoning that has been used for that movement. But now we're going to the next level. These people are born this way. You have to accept this. Speaking of pedophilia. Now, this is something interesting. At this point, the argument that you're seeing, at least pretty much in the mainstream, is, well, we're born this way, so don't judge us. And besides, we're not a threat to your children. There was actually an article on September 21st in Salon.com that was titled, "I'm a Pedophile, But Not a Monster." This is written by a man named Todd Nickerson. And I'll just read a couple of quotes from this article. He says, "I've been stuck with the most unfortunate of sexual orientations, a preference for a group of people who are legally, morally, and psychologically unable to reciprocate my feelings and desires." And he says, "Yet I'm not the monster you think me to be. I've never touched a child sexually in my life and never will, nor do I use child pornography." So this is an article that he's basically meant to be a sympathetic individual, that we're meant to sympathize with his situation. In this past Sunday's edition of the British paper, The Independent, there was an article by a prominent psychologist, Dr. Glenn Wilson. The title of this article is, "Not All Pedophiles Are Bad People. We Need to Have a Sense of Proportion." This is what this psychologist says. "In my studies of the pedophile information exchange in the 1980s, many members admitted sexual feelings for children which they had been able to contain or turn to social good. These feelings actually benefited society because these people handled them the right way. He says some gravitated toward occupations such as school teacher or social worker, where they could enjoy the company of children without plotting abuse. So he's saying, you know, this can be a good thing if pedophiles find jobs working with children. They're gravitating toward these jobs because they want to enjoy children's company, not necessarily because they want to abuse them. He said, it is possible to be attracted to children as a sexual orientation without acting upon those desires. And this man, Dr. Glenn Wilson, he spoke to The Telegraph, and he said, pedophilia should be viewed as a type of sexual orientation which is not necessarily acted upon. Here's a simple question for you. Are you comforted by the idea of public acceptance of pedophilia, since these people won't necessarily act on those desires? Do you want a pedophile being your child's teacher or social worker so that this individual can enjoy the company of children, with the idea that, well, it's possible for them to be attracted to children without acting on those desires? He's not necessarily going to abuse your child. He probably won't abuse your child. Does that comfort you? This Salon.com article says, you know, the title is, I'm a pedophile, but I'm not a monster. This is an article that's aimed to help you to sympathize with this man who has these feelings for children. But even he says that someone who acts on those feelings is a monster. This man who wrote this article and who has these feelings, he says, I'm not a monster because I don't act on them. This psychologist in Britain says, well, you know, this is all okay because these people probably aren't going to act on it. But think about this. If genetics determines morality, then why would it be wrong for a pedophile to act on those desires? Why can we say, well, yes, we understand pedophilias who act on it are monsters, but then we say homosexuality is morally right because, wait, you're born that way. You know, that's what your genetics predisposes you to do, so therefore it's morally acceptable. I want to just read a couple of quotes from an article by Selwyn Duke. This was on New American. He says this, today, mainly due to the effort to legitimize homosexuality, the notion that it's okay if I was born that way has taken hold, often articulated as God doesn't make mistakes. It's rhetorically very effective. Of course, whether an atheist who considers the world naturally flawed or a theist believing it supernaturally fallen, cleft-lipped, spina bifida, Down syndrome, club foot, Tay-Sachs disease, and other abnormalities make clear that God's perfection isn't enjoyed by man. And is it logical to consider the brain, the one organ, immune from this imperfection? It's a good question. You know, there are all kinds of things that go wrong, and why would we say that whatever happens to happen in the brain, that this is irreproachable? Note also, he says, that the same psychologists telling us homosexuality is innate also say that psychopaths are born and not made. Now, if some people were born with homicidal instincts, would it be all right for them to commit murder? It might seem like a silly question, but we're talking about essentially morally the same thing. And if it's wrong to justify pedophilia because supposedly some people are born that way, well, then it's also wrong to justify homosexuality for the same reason, isn't it? You can't have it both ways. Either genetics determines morality or it doesn't. And the plain and simple truth is that it doesn't. It does not. Genetics does not determine morality. Here's another question. These individuals who are pushing this way of thinking, they're trying to get us to sympathize with the pedophile who has these feelings. And they're saying, you know, look, he's not going to hurt your child. But do you think that's all they're trying to do? Are they only trying to get us to sympathize with celibate pedophiles? If you think that that's all they're trying to do, you are an extremely naive person. Just consider a few more trends, and Mr. Duke covers these in his New American article. He talks about these different Hollywood movies that have been portraying adult-child relationships in very tender ways. He cites this film from 1993, For a Lost Soldier, quite vividly and sympathetically relates the true story of a World War II era sexual relationship between a Canadian serviceman and a 13-year-old European boy. Quotes a New York Times review of this article that says that it really invests this romantic relationship between a grown-up and a child with an aching tenderness. There was 2001's movie Lie, L-I-E, which features a pederast named Big John. The Times also had a really positive review of this movie. Of course, such films and their reviews are still rare, but the relativism justifying them and a whole lot more is anything but. Hollywood pedophiles are apparently everywhere like vultures, as former child actor Corey Feldman put it, but they're protected by power and privilege. Another set of trends. Obama's military brass has ordered American soldiers in Afghanistan to ignore the sexual abuse of young boys by Afghan allies, quote unquote, even on U.S. military bases, partially in deference to, quote, cultural sensitivity. Also in the UK, politically correct authorities have ignored Muslim child sex trafficking rings for fear of being called racist. These things are happening in our midst. Our government is covering up. The UK government is acting like this is okay. This is really something to pay attention to. The homosexual movement has completely changed our culture in a very short amount of time, and people are now accepting of things and supportive of things that they were completely opposed to just a few short years ago, and this is tracking in the exact same direction. And you may think that you would never be affected by this, and maybe you wouldn't, but consider this. A Barna Group research study found that in 2002, already only 6% of teens believed in moral absolutes. 6% in 2002. These are all adults who can vote now, 13 years later. The morality of our youth is a whole lot more fluid than it has ever been before. And this is going to have massive implications on our society. We have a book about how the homosexual movement has changed society. It's called Redefining Family. Redefining Family. It has chapters called The Homosexual Revolution, Questions That Demand Answers, Why Family, The Enemy of Family. It explores the attitude, it doesn't affect me. And it talks about how God is trying to save all mankind, and he has a plan to do that, and it is has everything to do with this particular issue. This is an important thing to understand and, frankly, important to protect yourself from. You can find Redefining Family under the Literature tab on thetrumpet.com.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Is the food you eat contributing to your good health, or is it causing you problems? A new study shows how for so many people around the world, the answer is the latter, and it gives some specifics that you'll be interested to know. The leading authorities on global disease issued a report last month. This is the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation. And this was published in the Lancet Medical Journal. This is an update of a 2010 study called The Global Burden of Disease. They took data from 108 countries, and they describe a number of risk factors for premature death around the world. This report says that half of the world's deaths come from preventable risks. So to tell us more about this report and what we might want to do about it, I have with me Jorg Mardian. He's a professional nutritionist and a personal trainer from British Columbia, Canada, and an overall highly knowledgeable and excellent fellow. I have him online via Skype. Hello, Jorg.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing terrific. So this study, this obviously talks about a lot of factors leading to disease and early death. Maybe you can just give us some of the findings as it relates specifically to diet.
Absolutely. It is a very big study, and they're really trying to extrapolate quite a bit of information from it. What I took mostly from this is that the dietary is the biggest component out of the four, there's actually 14 dietary risk factors that they were speaking of. So, you know, some of those are unhealthy eating, including diets low in fruit, whole grains and vegetables, and diets as well high in red meat and sugar-sweetened beverages. And these type of things contribute to more deaths than they said any other factors, you know, causing a lot of heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. So it's pretty big. And what I took away from this is that the poor diet now, according to the Global Burden of Disease study, has overtaken poor sanitation as the number one cause now of early death. So that's huge.
Yeah, we tend to think of, places where they have bad sanitation or a lack of clean water or that type of thing as contributing to a whole lot more deaths. But so this is actually saying diet is the biggest contributor of early death.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's scary because we're now going into countries that are spreading the message of refined foods. And this is the effect of the cause. So as an example, you can get a company that is big in refined foods that used to be in North America, and now they're going into poorer countries and saying, look, we need to spread the message about what we do. However, we're getting a lot more now from that because the effects of eating too much refined foods is what we're seeing in this study right now. And it's reaching people that normally wouldn't eat this type of food.
Okay, so you're from your standpoint and from your knowledge base, would you say that say America and we'll add Canada to this? You're Canadian, and I imagine that it's fairly comparable. But are we kind of the source of the most refined? Like we have the most say technologically oriented food production in the world?
Well, Western society for sure. I mean, you go into the affluent countries, we can say North America, of course, but all Western countries are, you can walk into anywhere right now, I mean, and say, yes, these are the countries that have started it. I mean, if we look at America, I mean, look, well, we don't want to name, but if you look at America and you look at some of the countries, the companies that have started there early in the 50s and 60s, and they took root. And then they spread through the, you know, the Western society, the affluent countries. And then the spillover now is that these same companies that have become a landmark company in Western society, especially in North America, are now popping up in countries like China and Russia and then even more so into countries that are we consider normally poor. Mm-hmm. So, yes. Western society, and if we say North America, they are pushing this type of diet onto other countries in the name of profits.
So from what you can discern from this study, it's essentially that the fact that we're exporting our food production elsewhere around the world that's creating the higher numbers and pushing poor diet into that number one tier of early death, preventable death, according to this study.
That's what certainly what it looks like. I mean, this is new.
So just the specifics that you mentioned, you talk about, you were talking about refined foods. This study specifically mentions sugar, refined sugar in our beverages, and it mentions red meat, among a few other things. Maybe you can just give us a kind of tell us the top problems in, say, the average American diet or the Western diet that's contributing to some of these health problems.
Well, the top problems is again, we're going to get back to the cause, is refined foods. And refined foods, it's what's in those foods and what's lacking. So it's not only what they add, it's what's taken away. So we look at sugar-sweetened foods or beverages. We're now taking in average. It used to be 120 pounds a year, they say. Now it's up to almost 140. And they say some people take in almost over 200 pounds of sugar a year. It's not everybody, of course, but I was staggered when I heard that. And you can imagine what your body does. It's just a frontal assault. It's just a smashing to the organs and all the tissues of the body. And then we have bad fats like rancid fats and trans fats and such. And then we have chemicals and additives and whatever they put in there. And if we're not experts on reading this stuff, and that's what I find, that people don't do that, we're really going to suffer. So that's the sugar. You know, if we look at it, sugar is a big, big issue. I'm not so sure. I understand about the refined meats and what they do to meats, of course. I mean, it really is a tragedy what's being done to meat today. And I agree with that, that it does cause a lot of problems. But they said meat in general is a probable cause of cancer. Now, I'm not sure I agree with that, because when we're looking at, say, grass-fed beef or beef that's raised ethically, the way it's supposed to be raised without steroids and hormones and that I counsel my clients to eat, because there's just no data to say that this is bad for you. So
quality matters. Red meat, like they're talking about red meat generally, and probably for the most part, a lot of the meat or most of the meat that's consumed does have problems with it. But you're saying meat that's produced the right way, it's very healthful.
Absolutely.
So this report also talks about excessive salt consumption. That was something that pricked my ears, because I've heard different things about that. Is that another thing where it's a matter of like what kind of salt you're consuming?
Yes, it is. Salt, again, is heavily refined. And then when we people don't really use much in moderation anymore. I really advocate moderation. And so when you're using a refined salt in higher amounts, it does lead to a lot of problems with the body. And I always tell people, look, take natural salts, rock salts, Himalayan salts that have the nutrients in it still, the way that it's supposed to be taken into the body, rather than refined and lacking those nutrients. And quite honestly, anybody I've dealt with over the years has never had a problem with salt consumption when it's done in that way.
So a report like this comes out, you're in the business of helping people clean up their diet. Is this the type of thing that you can say, look, this is what I've been telling you, they're backing up what I'm saying? Do the results of a study like this, do they reinforce the main things that you tend to go after when you're trying to help someone to clean up their diet?
Oh, absolutely. It is. We're glad. I mean, we don't like to see studies like this. It's almost a tragedy to see how many people suffer from that. But we use it as a tool as well in our industry. And we say, look, there's a lot of people getting really sick and a lot of people dying. Now, what can we extrapolate from that data? So if I have someone sitting across from me, I say, look, we have this study and the experts are all agreeing. We're in agreement that this is causing you to be sick or to die early. So can we use that as a motivating factor to help you overcome your problems? And yes, it does put a little bit of an impetus behind some people to get going.
And so where do you start with someone when you're trying to help them to eat cleaner?
Well, I mean, when you look across, you'll hear this all the time. I'm really confused. I'm looking on the internet and I just don't know where to start.
Right.
And I just call it a lot of white noise. Everybody has something to say. And nutrition experts really do agree that good diet is good for you. There's no problems there. It's where they disagree that the problem is.
So, right. It gives the people, they basically say, well, I read this in this place. I read this other thing that contradicted it over here. And so the whole thing is just a bunch of hooey. I'm just going to ignore it. I'm going to go ahead and eat my Big Mac.
That's true. So the way that I look at it is, look, let's educate you. And where nutritionists excel is in sitting someone down and saying, look, we're going to take that white noise. We're going to parse it. We're going to bring it down to something that you can concentrate on. And really, let's look at what we need to do. And that's eating whole foods. Getting down to the basics. What's causing the problems in your life? Just take all the information, give me the information of what you're doing, and then I'm going to refine that a little bit, so to speak, and then bring it down to a nub and say, this is what we need to do. Take this out and put this in, and your body's going to react. They're really what they are. They're health laws. You're just saying, it's like a law of gravity. If I jump off a cliff, for sure, you're going to hear a splat in a couple of seconds. Well, health laws are the same. You know, if you don't follow them, there's something. If you eat good foods, good things happen. If you eat bad foods, bad things happen. It's that simple.
You said whole foods. Tell us what you mean.
Well, whole foods are the type that would be more close to nature. Really, people don't eat a lot of vegetables. People eat too many refined carbohydrates rather than carbohydrates like, say, grains that you can cook. So, say, oatmeals or ancient grains, they'd rather eat cereals from boxes for convenience sake. So whole foods are more foods that are untouched by man. And that's, it takes a little more work, but I've seen astounding results in weeks from people who just add. My biggest advice is to tell people on your plate, always make sure you have a double portion of vegetables. You have, and I go by fist size for most people, fist size portion of protein, fist size portion of carbohydrates. And that's a moderate amount, you know, and really no one will starve in the next 1 or 2 hours until their next meal. Most of us are, we tend to eat for feeling good and by what's in it rather than nutrient content. We don't ask ourselves, will this make a difference in my life? We just eat because we really like that food. And so we can be conditioned by people saying this is a good for food for us when it really isn't. So whole food is just a food that you can put on a counter and say, you know what, if I leave this here, it's going to spoil in a short period of time. That's a whole food. A refined food is going to last you months and months.
What are some of the, say, the biggest challenges that people face? You talk about grass-fed beef versus, industry raised, or, you know, a cow that grows up on a feedlot or something like that. Obviously, a lot more expensive. A diet with a lot more fruits and veggies, that can be pretty expensive. What are some of the other obstacles that tend to cause people to go the other direction?
Well, I'm not sure I agree that a natural diet, is more expensive. I mean, what we do is we say, look, everybody says there's obstacles, but are they really there? With my clients, I tell them, look, to overcome, take obstacles, I really use my blender a lot for smoothies. I have a smoothie in the morning. You can put vegetables and fruit in there together. You can put healthy fats in there and lots of soups. Soups are inexpensive. And really eating in a moderate way and taking your vegetables and your other foods and just dividing them into 3 or 4 meals isn't expensive. I've really shown that to all my clients. And when they take the end of the month and they take an inventory, it's not. If you take refined foods and you take a box of something, I mean, you're getting almost nothing in there. So if you take that versus the amounts that you get for other foods, it really is about the same. And another factor is with whole foods, it satisfies more and it keeps you from snacking more because you have a higher nutrient content. So you're going to feel good and you just won't eat as much during the day.
Well, we've been talking with nutritionist Jorg Mardian about a new study about preventable disease and premature death from the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation. Really interesting stuff. I appreciate you giving us some of your time, Jorg, and we'll have to do this again.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whiles any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
Okay, so I have goosebumps now. So that was from Shakespeare's Henry V. That's Kenneth Branagh's version from 1989. It's the famous depiction of the battle that took place 600 years ago this week. On October 25th, 1415, there was a battle that Churchill called the most heroic of all the land battles England has ever fought. It's the Battle of Agincourt. I have with me here in the studio an avid student of history, Abraham Blondeau. He also happens to be one of our staff members here at KPCG. He's written an article about this battle for thetrumpet.com, looking back on what happened and the effect that it has had on British history. Hello, Abraham.
Hi, it's good to be here.
First off, I want to thank you for giving me an excuse to play that bit of speech on the program. But let's talk about this battle. What happened in the Battle of Agincourt historically?
Sure. Well, the battle takes place during the Hundred Years' War between England and France. And this war was mainly about who had the right to the throne of France. There were a lot of feudal provinces within France who wanted the English kings to rule over them. And a lot of, most of the mainland, though, was French. They were loyal to France. So during this long war, it was 100 years, there were many battles fought, and the Battle of Agincourt took place near the end. And Henry V, he was the king of the English, and he had been in power for 2 years, coming to the throne at the age of 26. And he wanted to go take and claim the French throne, as he had the right through the Archbishop of Canterbury approved it. And he thought he also had the hereditary right proven through law that he was the rightful heir. So that's why he embarked to France in the first place. So he sieged Harfleur, which is a fortress in northeast France, and then he marched to the Somme River. But as is oftentimes in medieval warfare, a lot of men got sick. Many were wounded. Out of his original army of 12,000 men, only 5,000 were left at the time of the battle. So the French army took a long time mobilizing itself. And once they did, they confronted Henry. And it's a very interesting setup to this battle. They offered him that if he would give him up his own self for ransom, that they would let his army go, and then England could pay a fee to have their king back, much like Richard the Lionheart had that happen to him when he was passing through Germany. So in the medieval times, this was very common for leaders to be ransomed for money. But he said no. He said he'd rather fight with his men and die than be ransomed. So they gave that again before the battle started, and he said no. So he had to fight his way through the French army to get back to England, which was his goal. So he decided to pitch the battle in a very strategic location for himself. He chose a farmer's field in between two patches of woods, so his flanks were protected. And he really was able to maximize the effect of the longbow. And this was the English specialty. This was their, all through the Hundred Years' War, this was their main unit in their army, and he set them up in six wedge formations and put stakes in front of them. So the French cavalry, which was their main unit in battle, heavy cavalry with the knights and the armor, they would be unable to break the English line. And as we heard earlier, the epic speech was made prior to the battle because they were outnumbered greatly, and that's why this battle is remembered so much, because historically, they believe they were outnumbered 5-1. Modern researchers suggest 2-1. But nevertheless, that is huge odds. He had about 5,000 men at the time, and then the French had at least 10,000. So outnumbered 2-1, they had no other option but to fight in battle. And that's what they did. And he did give a speech before, and Henry V, as we'll discuss later, Henry V, the play, has a version of that. But he did give a speech, and his men responded, and in 3 hours, they broke the French army. There were about 400 English dead and about 6,000 French dead.
So this is one of the reasons why Churchill and so many others have looked back on this history and said this is really unparalleled in British history. For people to be so outnumbered, for them to achieve such a overwhelming victory. What are some of the other elements of this that really demonstrate, say, the very best of British war-making ability?
Right. Yeah, the quote there you said at the beginning about Churchill saying this is the most heroic land battle in English history. I think that's interesting because he wrote that after the Battle of Britain, after he had his own experience But he still believed this was the most heroic. And besides the odds and besides the achievement they had of beating back the French, I think the main reason why Churchill believed that was because of it was a combination of the best leadership that England ever had from their king. It was some of the best soldiers they had, the highly trained longbowmen. And it was a sign of what normal people can do when they have great leadership. I think that as there were other battles before it that were very similar. The Battle of Crecy and Poitiers were very similar in nature, but I think Agincourt is remembered more because it really cemented England at the time as the prime power in Europe, and also gave the British people belief in themselves that they could fight off these much larger nations in Europe, and they could succeed.
So you've mentioned a couple of things about Henry V and how instrumental he was in ensuring the victory in this battle. What are some of the aspects of his leadership, and what are some of his achievements as a king that he's credited and remembered for?
Sure. Actually, there's this great quote by William Stubbs. He was a historian back in the 18th century, and he said this about Henry V. "No sovereign who ever reigned has won from contemporary writers such a singular unison of praise. He was religious, pure in life, temperate, liberal, careful, and yet splendid, merciful, truthful, and honorable, discreet in word, provident in counsel, prudent in judgment, modest in look, magnanimous in act, a brilliant soldier, a sound diplomatist, an able organizer and consolidator of all forces at his command, the restorer of the English navy, the founder of our military, international and maritime law, a true Englishman with all the greatness and none of the glaring faults of his Plantagenet ancestors." So I think that quote, he sums it up really well, and he lays a lot out there. But at the time before that, England in the medieval times were suffering a lot from internal dissension, from just a lot of poverty and internal strife. And Henry was able to quell all that. He was a young king, and people really believed it, that he could find a lot of change. He was a very impressive young man, and he also was able to put Parliament on his side, which was a huge advantage for him. And when we consider all these things, if we were to look at a leader who was very similar in nature, I think he strikes a figure close to that of King David. If we think of what he did anciently in Israel, and we talk about him quite a bit on the trumpet and other places, that he really galvanized the nation and was an example of courage and leadership that they could look to. And just a brief example of that is twice at Agincourt, before the battle, he offered to fight Charles VI of France in hand-to-hand combat, one-on-one, to end the whole disagreement. And the French king said no. And the other time was during the actual battle, he rushed into the hand-to-hand combat and rescued his brother who was injured. So he was willing to put his life on the line when he had to. So he was a very, very courageous young man, and he really started this belief in British military achievement, and also he really united the nation behind him and made it a uniquely English culture. And the reason for that was it was the first major battle where England won it without any European mercenaries. So it was an all-English battle. He was the first king to use English in his correspondence with home and in his legal documents. It was all English. So he really laid the foundation for what England would become later under Henry VIII and Elizabeth, really separating from the mainland and becoming their own entity separate from Europe. He was really the first king to start that movement.
What's interesting, in one of the aspects of this article that you wrote on thetrumpet.com on this subject that I found interesting, was the fact that you follow the history afterward, and it actually, in the big picture, didn't have a tremendous effect on history in the long run because of what happened after. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, it is a ironic thing that we remember it and hold it so high, but its immediate consequences were lost very quickly. Henry V, he died young king, and the consequences of that is his children and his grandchildren were not as apt to rule, and a lot of wars were fought afterwards trying to keep their possessions in France, and those failed. When you have a lot of battles away from so far away from your mainland, and the money and the loss of life after a while is a war of attrition, and eventually you won't be able to sustain that. So the England, that by the end of the Hundred Years' War, it was a stalemate. They kept everything they had in England, but they lost everything in France. So all the advantages won at Agincourt were lost by his children. So all the geopolitical consequences of the battle faded from history at that point.
But the legacy continues, and a big reason for that, and you bring this out in the article, is not only the details historically, the odds, the hero at the center of the story, and some of the elements that we've also discussed, but the fact that it was immortalized by William Shakespeare and some of the best poetry that he wrote.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the main reason why we remember it so well, and it's because it was written so well by Shakespeare and Henry V. And anybody who thinks of Agincourt, they immediately usually associate with the play. And even a lot of it has impacted our culture. The HBO series Band of Brothers has this title from the play. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of other things that we've derived it from. And as we heard the clip there from the movie at the beginning of this segment, it was just those words. Those have lasted 1600s when Shakespeare wrote those, so over 400 years, and they're just as powerful today as they were back then. And it was all inspired by true events. But the ironic thing is that the most stirring parts were fiction. Henry V never said those things, but those fictitious words impacted history themselves.
Well, he must have said something that was enough to galvanize the men at the time. Nobody could say it like Shakespeare, but mm-hmm. You look at the fruits of what he accomplished, and it had to have been pretty impressive.
Yes, yeah, there are the chronicles at that time do they don't have the exact words of what he said, but they do say that he did give a speech and it rallied the men. And the main thing he did was he asked God to help them in battle. That's recorded as well. And he did that afterwards too, several times, giving God the glory afterwards. And you have to admit, it was a very miraculous battle.
Well, it's an awesome history to look back on. We've been talking with Abraham Blondeau. He's written an article called The 600th Anniversary of Agincourt. You can find it online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Abraham, for bringing this story to our remembrance.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
But Daddy, you said we would play soccer when you got home from work. Right. The trouble is, when I said that I didn't know about that unplanned meeting that got me home 20 minutes later than usual, and plus I just didn't feel like running around at the moment. But how important is it for a child's parents to be true to their word? It's an important question. The implications might be bigger than we want to admit. How we act in that moment teaches our children a lot about character, about dependability, about trust. It even teaches them a lot about God. Imagine a man who wants to take his family on a trip, and he announces it to the whole family, and everybody's excited. But as the date of departure nears, obstacles arise, unexpected costs, unforeseen snags, other things that take precedence, and the trip just doesn't seem as important as it once did. So the father cancels the trip. Commenting on this hypothetical situation in his book, Man of Steel and Velvet, Aubrey Andelin wrote this: "The lack of follow-through on the part of the father can have a disheartening effect on the family. Not only is there a loss of enriching experiences that could just as well have been had, but the family suffers a certain lack of security, especially if it happens often. They will come to distrust their father's word. When new plans are presented, there will be doubt concerning the outcome. The family will lack faith that the plans will materialize, and disillusionment will set in." Andelin concludes, "Considering these doubts, it appears it would be best to follow through, even if it may not be quite as prudent as originally thought." Now, obviously, we're human, and unsurpassable obstructions can arise, and for that reason, it is wise to state plans as probabilities rather than absolute promises. But the basic point stands: how much does our dependability as fathers and mothers influence our children's faith? Wouldn't it be harder for a person to learn to trust God's word if his or her dad never kept his word? And wouldn't it be easier to simply believe God if dad was always trustworthy? Dependability is a defining characteristic of godly fatherhood. The very foundation of our faith is God's dependability. When our heavenly Father makes a promise, it's as good as done. We can count on him to fulfill every word. We can depend on him to follow through every time. James 1 and verse 17 says that with our Father, there is no variation or shadow due to change. God says in Isaiah 46, "My counsel shall stand." Romans 11 says that the gifts and the call of God are irrevocable. We parents need to strive to teach our children this quality of God by living it. When we say we'll do something, they should be able to count on us to follow through. It's tough sometimes. It takes sacrifice, not nearly as much sacrifice as God has made for us. But emulating God in this respect is a terrific thing to do as a parent. I call the command in Matthew 5 and verse 48 the Father's motto. It says, "Become you therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect." Not only does our success in this area build a foundation for our children's faith in God, it also gives them a model to emulate. I've talked with my children about the importance of keeping your word, and if I expect them to follow through with the things they say they'll do, I have to make sure I'm setting the example. I once attended the wedding of the daughter of one of my good friends, and when he spoke at the reception, he brought me to tears as he reminisced about how just yesterday this radiant woman in white was his sweet little pumpkin, running to greet him when he got home from work. I still have three of those pumpkins in my house. But as my friend told me when we spoke afterward, just blink and they're grown and gone. He said, "When my kids were growing up, I always made sure I made time for them right when I came home from work. Every day, my son would greet me with a ball in his hand. 'Dad, can we play?' A lot of times I wouldn't feel like it, but my wife always reminded me, 'You'd better take the opportunity while you've got it.' So I always did, even if it was for 5 minutes. I never told him no." That's great advice. I know at least three children who deserve to be able to count on their dad like that. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. This program is the voice of the Trumpet magazine. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. That's where to find the stories we talked about on the show today. That's where you can go to get a free subscription to this monthly news magazine, the Philadelphia Trumpet. We'd like to hear from you. Send us any comments or questions by emailing letters at thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Jorg Mardian and Abraham Blondeau. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. leave you with this thought from David Livingstone. I'm prepared to go anywhere, provided it be forward. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.